Well, good morning again. Now that you're half filled up with food, we're ready for another class. That's what I remember about this gathering, is that if the speaker didn't show up, nobody would really care. As long as the food over there was going good, everything was fine. Well, we didn't get very far in class one, but at least class one set the framework for Ecclesiastes, and really I wanted to set the game plan out right up front so you could see where we're headed. And then hopefully as we go through it, then it will make some sense when you run across some of these passages. So that was the purpose of class one. And the goal in class two is to get to Ecclesiastes 3, where he sees that God finally does things at the right time. And again, I would reiterate that really one of my great surprises going through this book is that I approached this thinking that Solomon originally was a bit of a skeptic, and that originally when he ran all his tests that he really didn't see God in this. But I came to realize as you're going through this very clearly that he sees God from the beginning. And in just conversations we had between the first and second class, you know, this comes out to people and you start realizing that really Solomon starts out where all of us start out. That you start out brought up in the truth. You know, some of you came to the truth, but you come to a point where you believe God exists and God is involved in your life. But what Solomon was working through was deeper issues than that, because we all have that. Everybody here believes God exists and God is working. What you then do is you move forward and start to realize, well, God is actually orchestrating things in your life. God is actually using the events of your life to change you. Not just God is out there working, but God actually expects me to respond to all of this. And that this is a learning procedure. He's treating us as children, as Paul would say in Hebrews 12. And what child is there that the father doesn't discipline? And he brings us through life with all these learning experiences, hoping that we will respond. Not just that we will endure through them, but that we're actually going to spiritually grow and mature to become children of God. And that was the surprise to me. I didn't realize that going through the book at the beginning. So, test one was looking at wisdom. So if you're ever wondering, if you're ever like one of those people that wonder, like, what if you were somebody who was really wise? What if you really had the wisdom of Solomon? Would life become easier for you? Would it be easier to serve God? Would it be easier to see God working in your life? You know, because sometimes you wonder that. You know, like James would say in chapter 1, when you're going through a problem, when you're experiencing suffering and trials, James 1, he says, is anybody, you know, going through this? Well, if you don't understand, if you don't have that wisdom, then ask God. Ask God about it. Pray to God about it and ask him for the wisdom to understand what he's doing. And it may be that God will let us at some point understand why we went through those problems and what we are supposed to learn from them. So Ecclesiastes 1 ended up with that, with looking at the issue of wisdom. And in the end, he perceived at the end of verse 17 that when he knows wisdom and madness and folly, I perceived that this also was grasping for the wind. To think that this wisdom is somehow going to make our life different, that we're going to become a better person. It will become easier to serve God. It will, you know, just by knowing all the things God's doing in our life, that will make it easier. If you'd like the kind of thing where you ever wondered, like, what if an angel stopped and talked to you? What if an angel would talk to you like they talked to Samson's mom and dad? What if an angel talked to you? Would that make the difference in your life? Would that like make it easier to serve God and then be aware of God's work in your life? And you start realizing, well, angels talk to other people in life. Some of them responded. Some people didn't respond. You know, Lot's wife saw an angel in her house and still looked back. It doesn't change everybody. So, you know, this is the kind of thing. Solomon went through this for us so that he can leave on record for us that if you're ever wondering, like, this would make the difference in your life, he's going to suggest to us, well, here's what happens. You try this, and you think it's going to do it, and it's like you're grasping at the wind, or you're feeding on the wind, and there's really nothing there. It's just a big smokescreen. It isn't going to bring profit, pleasure, happiness to your life. So then what he went after in chapter 2, what he sets out to them to do is he looks in chapter 2 and he says, all right, what if we go after you know, all these different building projects that I've got? I've got all this money and all this time. What if I just try pleasure? What if we run that test? Because those are really the two big tests that he ran, the one of wisdom and the one of all the pleasurable things that you think you might do. Would this make a difference in your life? What if you could have all these different things that you see other people have? Would this make it so that it was easier for you to serve God and that you realize God was working in your life and make you more of a spiritual person and bring some kind of profit to your life? So he says in chapter 2 that that's what he did. He set out to test with mirth, and therefore enjoy pleasure And he found out, well, it was just a bunch of vanity. That's what he did. So he sets out and tries to work through these different tests. So what he did is he tried pleasure. He tried all these different things. He went in verse 3. He searched in his heart how to gratify the flesh with wine. Now, maybe that will do it. Maybe if you like have parties and you set up happy parties and you bring in alcoholic beverages and you think, like, you see people today, you know, especially young people, you hear about this going on at colleges and universities, or you hear about people doing this sometimes at Halloween parties just recently. This is what makes people happy, and it's going to bring profit and pleasurableness to their life. And you think, well, maybe this is what is going to do it. And so he tries all these things, and he actually goes through them. He runs the test, trying to lay hold of these things. And he does it with his heart still guiding him with wisdom. So it's not like he just turned his back on God at this point and he went out and tried all these different things. What he is doing is he's investigating them while he's actually, he's analyzing the events to find out, does this really bring purpose to your life? Does this really satisfy you? Or is it just a big smokescreen? And he found out that that's really what happens. And in verse 3, he tried all these things. I might see what was good for the sons of men to do, because this is what he's looking for in life. What is it? What's profitable for you to do? What is good for you to do that's going to bring some kind of profit to your life under heaven all the days of your lives? And then in verse 4, he made great works, and he built for himself houses and planted vineyards. And he made gardens and orchards and all kinds of fruit trees. So he went out and tried all these different things that you might have an interest in. And you can see the variety that's there if you might be a construction person. So he's out there building homes. He's trying vineyards. Maybe you're the kind of person that likes to plant. You're the botanist in the family. And you like to try planting things. And you want to go through it. And you think, like, you know, having the best garden is going to somehow make a difference in your life. He tries all these things. He has orchards. You know, he gets male and female servants so that he can do all these different things and not have to work very hard. He's got all these house servants. You ever wondered where life would be so much easier and you'd have such a better life if you could just have some servants in your house to clean the house and take care of things? You wouldn't have to do all that work. And he tried all those things to find out, is that really going to bring you happiness and satisfaction? He's out there breeding herds and flocks. And then he brings in all this gold that he had coming in. All these different nations that David had conquered. What happened in Solomon's reign is they would all come in and they bring gifts every year. And he's just like collecting gold and silver, and he's just becoming richer and richer. In fact, the silver was so common, you know, they said silver was just like, it was like sand of the sea in his area. It's just like all over the place there was so much silver. It was hardly worth anything because there was so much. And then he became great, and he excelled beyond all the kings in Jerusalem before him. He really did just about try everything. You'll notice that what happens, though, in verse 12, after trying all these different things, and you find out, like, in fact, down at in verse, if you're keeping on down verse 10, whatever his eyes wanted, he didn't keep from them. He didn't withhold anything from his heart, any pleasure at all. And from his heart, he rejoiced in all his labor because he liked the projects. He liked doing the building projects. This is something Solomon really rejoiced in. And for in his reward from all of his labor that he got from the working. And then he looked on all the works that his hands had done and all the labor which he had, and indeed it was all vanity and grasping for the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So in the moment of the time when he's doing the projects, he actually enjoyed them. You find this is the kind of person Solomon was. He liked working. He liked doing these projects. But then what he'd do is lay in his bed at night and he'd analyze, he'd sit back and watch all this going on, and he'd try to figure out, but really, is this really accomplishing what I want? Is this really bringing the satisfaction of what I'm after in life and what God is doing with me here on this planet? And this is what Solomon would think through that a lot of us don't. And it, as he's going through this, he starts to realize that, well, maybe it isn't what I thought it was. And I really think he's left this on record for all of us, so that if you're ever the kind of person who's looking around at what other people have, as he will look at later in the book, and you're wishing, like, well, I wish I could have some of that. I wish I had their house, and I wish I had that job, and I wish I had their kids instead of mine, or I wish I had their parents instead of mine. If you're that kind of person, what Solomon is trying to help us realize is that, look, at even if you had those things, that's not going to solve the problems of your life. That's not going to bring you the satisfaction you thought it would. You sit there on this side of the fence and you think that, but when you're actually there, it really doesn't bring you that satisfaction, because he had it all, he tried it all, and he found out this is not really what we're after in life. It's not about the things of this world. All the projects that we build, all the things that we create, all the things that we make. In fact, as you're going through this, you get down to verse 12, that then he turned and he considered wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what has already been done. He really can't do new stuff, because he's looking down the line and he thinks about Rehoboam. Rehoboam's already been born at this point. Rehoboam would have been born the year before Solomon became king. And he's watching Rehoboam grow up. And he's really like, what's Rehoboam going to do when he becomes king? Well, all he can really do is the same thing I'm doing. He can take in, if he can at least, all this wealth and all this stuff. And he can do more building projects. He can have more gardens. He can have herds. This is all he can really do. Those are the limits of life. And he's starting to see that, wow, all you can really do is just what the person did before you. And it's not really accomplishing what he had aimed for. It's not going to bring that profit and satisfaction he was after for in life. But he did realize in verse 13, he saw that wisdom exceeds folly as light exceeds darkness. And he's acknowledging the fact that, well, although it may not get you what I'm after, I am realizing through all this that there is an advantage to wisdom in this life. That he finds out that's more profitable than being a foolish person. And as he'll comment on that as he goes through the book, he starts to see what foolish people end up doing. And it's actually better to have God's wisdom as you're going through this. Life will be better for you than for those that don't. But what frustrated him the most is you get down to verse 14. The wise man's eyes are in his head. The fool, he walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceived. Now see, there's one of those phrases. I myself perceived. Now you're starting to see a conclusion that he's come to. This is a recognition that he's realizing as he's going through his quest. So I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. That really frustrated him. That's going to come up again and again in this book. Whether you are using your goal of life is to walk by God's wisdom, or whether your goal of life is just to go out there and do what you can and you're the fool of the Proverbs. Whichever way you're going, what ends up happening in the end is one event comes to all. And he found that extremely frustrating. I don't think that's what Solomon had expected ahead of time. And what really, he goes on, he realizes down in verse 16, that look at, for all of that, it's vanity at the end of verse 15. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. So even though Solomon's done all these different projects and he's accomplished all this stuff, he's looking down the line of history, realizing that a few years goes by, 50 years, and nobody will even remember what I did. That's what happens. And this is life. This is part of the frustration of life. If you're one of those go-getter people who thinks you're going to accomplish so much and you're going to be remembered for it and you're going to build stuff that's going to be around for hundreds of years, he looks down the line and he realizes he's got the wisdom to think down the line and realize, you know what? People don't remember 50 years ago anymore what David did. They don't remember what happened before. And now they're not going to remember what I did either. And that's a deeper thinker than a lot of us. Many of us don't even get to that point in life. We just go through motions without analyzing it. He's trying to figure it out as he goes through this. So this is going to come up again in chapter 9. And so what happens, Solomon's response is that he hated life. You know, you look at him and you wonder, well, how could that happen? Well, he hates life because he found this so frustrating to him. You see it on verse 17. Therefore, I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me. It's all is his vanity and grasping for the wind. He's frustrated still because he can't see yet what God is doing with this. And he says, for all of my efforts, for all of this work, and you can look at it even in terms of like ecclesial projects. He had built God's temple. You know, spent 7 years putting together the temple. And then 13 years he's working on his house and builds a house for Pharaoh's daughter. And he's doing all these ecclesial projects. And then he realizes down the line, like some of you may in ecclesial life, suppose you were working in the ecclesia, maybe you're supplying food for the ecclesia, maybe you're the person who's doing the seminars, maybe you've been the recording brother for years or whatever, and you're trying to do all this stuff for the ecclesia, and you look down the line and you realize, you know, people don't even remember who that person was 50 years ago. None of these people that we're working with today, hardly anybody even remembers them. And even if you accomplish all this stuff you're trying to get done, 50 years goes by and nobody even knows. Hardly, you know, back then, you know, maybe the records were even as good as we have today with computers and people can pass on information that at least you know what happened 50 years ago. But who even cares to read it? We don't care what happened 50 years ago. This is human life. And he's frustrated over the fact that all this energy he's been pouring into his life, he's looking down the line and finding out it's not going to accomplish what he thought. He originally thought it was going to be something that would be a heritage he would leave behind, that his kids and his grandkids and his grand-grandkids, that all they would have all this stuff that he had put together and build on it. And he finds out, well, maybe it isn't going to happen. In fact, he probably knew Rehoboam, and he knew what kind of kid Rehoboam was growing up, and realized that things were going to get bad. He may have actually figured this out as he's going through his life. Rehoboam's, 41 years old when he takes over as king. So Solomon knew his son real well. And he may have realized that Rehoboam, he doesn't appreciate the temple. He never went through that experience like I did of putting it all together and doing the temple dedication and all that. He doesn't care that much about it. Rehoboam comes along, the king invades from the north. He starts stripping out the gold of the temple and giving it away. He doesn't care. And this is what Solomon saw coming, that all this stuff was just going to deteriorate so fast that he thought he had put together. And it would be frustrating to realize that these things. So, you know, if we're wondering, like, well, what if we could do all those great things? He's been through that and realizes that even that isn't going to last. That isn't what God's after. It's not about the stuff that gets done that God's after. It's about changing our characters along the way. And this is what Solomon had to come to. And you'll see that as we get into this. So he hates life at this point, very frustrated at the fact that for whether you're good or you're bad, or whatever you're doing in life, that in the end, the day comes where we all go to the same place. And death just levels the playing field. And it's like, in the end, everybody dies. No matter what kind of life you have led. And he saw that as frustrating, that in the end, that all go to one place. And you know, you'll see that in chapter 9, in some of the famous passages we look at. Now, when you go back and try to understand what went wrong with Solomon, you know, because I really believe at this point in life in Ecclesiastes, he's looking back over events earlier in life. I really think myself, he wrote the book probably near the end when he was probably almost dying. But he's looking back at a younger period of his life when he was going through all these projects, which we found in chapter 2. He built all this stuff. So we know these are all things that he was doing back then, building the temple, building the house for himself, and all these projects that he's going on. Well, early in Solomon's life, he started putting together these proverbs. And some of these proverbs may have come from his dad, some of them came from others, but he puts together these proverbs. And you start looking through the proverbs, and you ever noticed how going through proverbs that everything is black and white, there's very little gray? Now some of you may have picked that up as you read the proverbs. And so you read things like Proverbs 2, that don't go down to the harlot and the adulteress, because her house leads to death and her paths to the dead. You see things like chapter 5, that her feet go down to death, her steps lay hold of hell. Chapter 7, still same issue, right? Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. And he's thinking back over these things that were black and white issues, thinking this is what's supposed to happen if you go the way of the harlot. If you go the way of the wicked and the way of the righteous, this isn't going to happen to them. They can't go down this same kind of pathway. Whereas in chapter 11 at verse 19 of the Proverbs, as righteousness leads to life, so he who pursues evil pursues it to his own death. Chapter 14, verse 12, there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. And you get all these contrasts that are there in the Proverbs. And it may be that Solomon misunderstood and that he was expecting that by doing all these right things in life, that by being really involved in the ecclesia, that by being the kind of person that really gives your life to God, that somehow in this life, your life was going to be better. And I think he became very frustrated when he saw that's not what happens all the time. It does for some people, but it doesn't happen consistently. And this bothered him because that's not what he expected about life. He saw in his kingdom and he watched the people as he knew and he knew what was going on in his kingdom. And he saw there were people who were extremely righteous from his perspective and they would end up suffering all kinds of things. They end up suffering like the path of what the wicked should get. And then there were wicked people on the other hand who had lives where like God doesn't touch them. And he lets them go through life and they seem to be unscathed by the events of life. And they get the life that you would expect the righteous to get. Very similar to what Job was going through earlier in the story in Job. And Solomon watches this happen and figures, this isn't what's supposed to happen. This isn't what even the Proverbs had seemed to indicate. It shouldn't go this way. And I think what you'll find is that this frustrated him a lot because he's thinking about life in general. This would be one of those issues for us sitting here this weekend that you go home from this study and you start realizing that, wow, you know, this is the natural tendency of all of us sitting here. We want to believe that if our life is going well and we're healthy and things are going good, we've got a job, we've got a house, and everything is going well in our life, we want to believe that God is blessing us in such a way that He's putting a stamp of approval on our life, and that means I'm okay. And for the other people that don't have that, we look around and we think, there must be something going on in their life. I don't necessarily know what it is, but something must be going on that God's working in their life and He's trying to change them, not me. And this is a huge problem for any Bible believers. And Solomon is working through this. And it's fun to watch him work through it, but it's what it is. He's left it on record for us because this is typical of what all the believers go through. We all go through this in life. This was what actually was bothering Job. This is a fundamental human problem. We want to believe that if things are going well. A few come up and they ask me, oh, how you doing, Jim? And I say, oh, well, things are great. You know, we're healthy. You know, I got a nice place out in California. You know, all these things are good in your life. And the tendency is to want to think then that, well, that's because I'm doing the right things. God's blessing me. And it may be that He is blessing me. And you thank Him for all those things. But that doesn't mean He's putting a stamp of approval on your life. It doesn't mean that means that, you know, well, I'm okay and other people aren't. That isn't how He works. He works in ways that you'll come to find out, with all the wisdom you have, you can't figure it out. Or what Paul would say, that His ways are like unsearchable. You really can't look around at everybody in this room and analyze what God is doing in their life by the events that are happening in their life. Can't do it. And Solomon finally came to understand that. And it frustrated him because he thought, when he started out, he thought you could. He thought you could like just analyze life by looking at what's happening in your life. And he finds out you really can't. It's not consistent that way as you go through. So he points out at the end of chapter 2 that for all of your work that you do, for all of that hard work that you accomplish, and imagine how he did this. You know, he had worked so hard on building the temple and building his own house for 13 years and repairing the Milo and on the tower that was there and fixing up Jerusalem and planting all these gardens and having all these herds, and he got all this stuff that he passes on to Rehoboam, and he realizes that for all of that, what do? You pass it on to somebody else, and they might be a fool. And what was it for? What did you do it for? What was it all about? Because you pass it on to somebody else, and in the end, you really don't know. You have no control how they're going to use this stuff. That frustrated Solomon. You see that down in verse 19. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor, which I toiled, in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. And this is vanity. This is like, what's the point of it? Why did I go through all this? If all that's going to happen is it gets turned over to somebody else who might totally misuse it. And you can watch that happening in the lives of kings, the kings of Judah all the time, that some would do wise things. Yeah, look at all the things Josiah did. Josiah turns the kingdom over to all his kids, and you know there was not another good one after him. So this is the problem that you run into in life. But in all of this, he maintains his understanding that God is in control. He just doesn't understand what God is doing. Somehow this has to be right, but he doesn't figure it out. And in verse 21, you see that this person you turn it over to, it's possible that you could leave your heritage to a man who has not labored for it. And this is vanity and a great evil. That's how he saw this, is that this person didn't work for it. This person may not care about it, but this is what happens in life. So if that's the case in verse 22, for what a man has worked for all his labor and for the striving of his heart which he's toiled under the sun, for all his days are sorrowful and his work grievous, even in the nights his heart takes no rest, this is all vanity. And what he's trying to tell us, brethren and sisters, and young people that are here, is don't spend your life striving for the wind. Don't be that kind of person. Don't get so super stressed out over what you might want to accomplish in life. Right now you have these visions of the young person of, oh, I want to get this job, and I want to have this kind of house. And some of you are thinking, oh, I want to have this kind of marriage, and I want to have this kind of wedding. And you have all these visions of like what you think you might want to have and what's going to bring happiness and profit and satisfaction to your life. And Solomon's trying to tell us, no, been there, done that, and it's not going to give you what you think it will. It's a big smokescreen. You think it's going to make you happy. You think it's going to bring profit to your life. You think ahead of time that maybe this is going to make the difference. It doesn't. You do need to have enough, as he's going to say. You need to have enough, but you don't have to be the kind of person who is stressed out and you're striving for more and you're striving. So that's what he sees as he goes along right there in verse 24. And you'll wonder, like, why does he every so often throw in this phrase, like verse 24? There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Isn't that interesting? See, these are the kind of passages that make you realize that Solomon's not a skeptic. He's not the kind of person who's just going after life without God in mind at all. What he's realizing as he's coming along is that, look, don't be the stressed out person that goes after this and this and this and thinks this is going to bring you happiness. Instead, just be the normal person who works what God has given you and you take the time to enjoy it. You know, you sit back and you smell the roses. You take the time. That will bring you more happiness and satisfaction than striving after the wind. And this is what he came to understand. A man who had all the money in the world, had all the wisdom in the world, all the power in the world to do whatever he wanted to build, and he realizes that, wow, in the end, the best thing you should do is just enjoy what God has given you. It's from the hand of God, and that's the way we should see it. Instead of striving for what he hasn't given to us. What he hasn't given to you. And this is what we do as people. We're always going after stuff that God hasn't given us. Now, this doesn't mean that you sort of sit back and just say, all right, God, take care of me and feed me and I don't do anything. Solomon never took that approach. He just figures you work. You do your labor and you work your job and you do what you can to have enough. And that's the problem, is what is enough? And then you take the time to enjoy what God has given you and recognize that it's all from the hand of God. For in verse 25, for who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? I mean, isn't that honest? It's a true statement that he would say. Who could have more than Solomon? Nobody. Now, maybe some of us think we do because we live as kings today. You know, we get all the food that we want. You know, we have all kinds of stuff coming into us, and some of us live the life of Solomon. But back then, people didn't have that. And you can see how he would say to people over thousands of years, who can have more than Solomon? He's got everything he wants except for this understanding about what God is doing. And he's trying to figure that out. But he tries to help us realize there that, look, God gives, in verse 26, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. These are gifts of God to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This is also vanity and grasping for the wind. Now that's like a general statement that he gives at this point. It doesn't mean that every case is like that, but in general, this is what God is doing. He's working in this world today, and he's providing enough for all of his children. And he will make sure that his children get enough. That's what God does. But we don't want to be the kind of person who's always out there striving for the extra. I want the extra thing. I want more stuff. And instead, what we want to do is be the person who learns to be content. And I think you'll see as we go along that contentment becomes a big issue with Solomon. He wants us to learn to be content. So chapter 3, when you get into 3, this is one of the common ones. Right? Chapter 3, when you have like there's a time for everything. We find out there's a time for, chapter 3, here we go. There's a time. Everything has its season and its time, its purpose under heaven. Now, these are common phrases that you're going to look at here in chapter 3. You see these sometimes on plaques that people put in their home, you know, that there's a time for this and a time for that. There's a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what's planted. Now, what is all this about in this book? And what Solomon's doing right now is he's analyzing life still. He's gone through the test of wisdom. He's gone through the test of having all the stuff you'd ever want. Is that going to solve the problem? Is that going to bring real true happiness in your life right now? And he looks at life and he says, all right, for everything there's a season. There's a set time. That's actually what the word means there. It's used in Nehemiah 2 when the king set a time. For Nehemiah was going to go back to the land and come back to report to the king, and he set him a time. He gave him a period in which you're going to do that. So it's not just a general thing. It's a set time. There's a set time for everything. There is a time to be born and a time to die. There's a time to plant. There's a time to harvest. So Solomon isn't just a sit-back person. He realizes there's a time to get out there and do work. That phrase there about scattering stones, you may wonder, like, why is that there and the time to remove them? That seems to be a time of war. What they would do back then is that you would, if you were going to be a farmer and you're going to plow the land, you'd get rid of all the stones in the land. What you would do when you came in for war, if you were trying to prevent people from growing crops, is they'd scatter stones all over the land. You see that done in some of the kings. So that's what's there. Time to tear, time to sow. So there's a right time to do all these contrasting things. And what happens is Solomon looks at all those things and he says, look it, we don't know when the right time is. We think we do. We try to figure it out. We try to find out when to do this and when to do that. We try to find some of these things out, but we don't really have the wisdom to understand when these things are supposed to be done. What he did do is he was totally convinced that God does. Now you look, for example, at a Bible case. Take the case of Abraham and Sarah. Abraham and Sarah, they're waiting to have a child. God's made a promise to them. Through you, Abraham, like the stars of heaven, I'm going to bless your family. And the time's going, and Sarah's getting older, and Abraham's getting older. Sarah's to a point where she's past an age of having children. And so she takes Hagar and says, Abraham, there's the solution. All right, we know you're supposed to have a kid. Maybe we're supposed to do this through Hagar. And she plans it her way. But the problem is, for all of us, we don't know the time. We don't. But Solomon has the confidence that God does. And Abraham and Sarah, in a sense, they made a mistake because God intended for Sarah to have a son. But he wanted him to wait so long that it would be very clear to everybody that this wasn't a child of Abraham and Sarah's doing. In fact, he lets them have a child to let them know that to him who works, as Paul would say in Romans 9, or to him who runs, which is what they were doing. They were working and they were running after having this child. Paul says, look, that's not how God's election works. God's election works in such a way that God says, I'm going to do it my way, and my way will be the right way. I'm going to have a child, and even though you're old, Sarah, you're going to have a child because it's going to be of God, and it will be clear to everybody that it wasn't of you, that it was of God. So this is, God's got this overriding plan involved that from our perspective, we don't always get it. Or we think sometimes we got to jump in and do things like Abraham and Sarah did. We got to do it for God. You know, and yet God will figure it out. He does things at the right time, as Solomon will say. Well, in this case, with Abraham and Sarah, you can see how that worked. So in chapter 9, then, you know, what prophet, in chapter 3 at verse 9, what prophet has the worker from that with which he labors? But I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. See, Solomon never questions what God's doing. He doesn't. He understands God's got this figured out. Solomon doesn't have it figured out, but he knows, he's got this confidence in God all the way through this book, that God does things at the right time. This is what God does. So he goes through this and he says, look, God does it. He refers to it in verse 10. He says, look, I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Young's literal translate that, but by which men are to be humbled. And he's starting to understand that all this work that you're doing, it isn't so much about what I get done, but that God's given us this to humble us, to work with us. This is how he works with people. In fact, you'll notice that what he dropped here at this point, when you start watching how Solomon is learning as he goes through, back in chapter 1 when he said the same kind of thing, he called it a grievous task or a burdensome task that we have to do. Well, you notice how he drops that right here in verse 10. And he sees this as a God-given task. God's using this. And God's doing these things, all these different things that he's just mentioned earlier in the chapter, a time for this and a time for that. He's using all of those in order to train his children. And Solomon will finally come to that. And he has put eternity in their hearts. Now, I know a lot of us like to quote that verse. We think that, well, that shows that somehow that God has put eternity in there, and Solomon's thinking about eternal life and all that, which I do think he is thinking about in periods in this book. But I like the way the Jerusalem Bible translated that, and within the context, when you try to understand, why does this eternity just show up right now? This isn't just the passage to try to show that the righteous get eternal life. That's not what this is about. What Solomon is trying to say, that look at, you know, I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied, or to which we're going to be humbled by what we have to do. He has made everything beautiful in its time. God did it all right. He made it all beautiful. He's thinking back to the creation, the things that God made, and he made it all right, and everything he does since then has been right. But what he has done is he's allowed us to look at time. And this is what chapter 3 is doing. Chapter 3 introduces this concept of looking over years. And you look at time, as the Jerusalem Bible says, but though he has permitted man to consider time in its fullness. So we can look back over the events of time. We can look forward in the events of time. So we can try to analyze life with what we can, our framework of time. And although God allows us to do that, he goes on and he says, but nobody can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end. So even though God has allowed us, he's allowed us to expand our minds and consider the concept that God worked back then and he's working towards our future, he hasn't allowed anybody to figure it all out and put it all together so that you can understand the work that God does from beginning to end. And Solomon is coming to get that. You know, I don't think he started out that way. He figured with all his wisdom he was going to be able to analyze life. He's going to be able to figure it all out. And even he is starting to realize that, wow, even with that ability of being able to look to the past and look to the future, God is not allowing us to understand everything that he's doing. It's too big. We couldn't understand it because God has so many things he's balancing and he's working in, trying to change people's lives. But in verse 12, he goes on and says, look, I know that there is nothing better than for them to rejoice and to do good in their lives. This is what he sees as what we can be doing right now. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. So when we sit down today and we have lunch and we're served all that good food and we get to eat, we don't sit there and brood over the fact of what's coming. We don't worry about the fact that God has allowed us to have this and there's other people today that are starving. There are. You look at the pictures of the people in New York City just trying to get enough food and water to survive. What we do instead is we take the gifts of God and we thank God for them at this time. And that's what Solomon came to see. You can't overanalyze all those different things, but take the gifts that God gives you. It's better for them to rejoice and do good in their lives and accept that we eat and we drink and enjoy the good of the labor. This is the gift of God. God wants us. As you're going through this book, you'll see God wants you to enjoy life. He doesn't expect people to go through life frustrated and depressed. I remember when some people back in California found out I was doing Ecclesiastes, their original comment was, oh, that's such a depressing book. And it's not a depressing book. What's depressing is where Solomon starts, frustrated over what he didn't understand. But what he comes to realize about life is so exciting, that God wants you to enjoy life. He wants you to accept his gifts. And you don't have to sit and fret and worry over what is coming. He will take care of it. And when things happen and when they come, we deal with them. But we have the peace of mind to know that God is in control. Because he knows in verse 14, I know. See, look at verse 12 was like that. I know that there is nothing. Verse 14, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. These are things he's come to get and he's realizing them and he's got it fixed. These are the facts of what he's putting out there as part of the wisdom that he has. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing will be taken from it. And God does it that men should fear before him. See, this is the response God's after. He's doing all these things so that we will fear him and we will keep his commandments, as he'll come to in chapter 12. He's trying to grab our attention to get us to realize he's working in our life, not just so that we get frustrated and depressed and we sit back and we sort of passively just say, oh, I'm just supposed to take whatever God throws at me. He's doing it so that we'll fear him, we'll change, and we'll become more like him. That's what he's after. He's trying to train us to be his children. And he uses these experiences of life to do that. And so we do enjoy. We enjoy these things knowing that they are the gift of God. Because God, he knows these things from the beginning to the end. You'll see that in verse 15. And that which has already been, and what has already is what is, that which is has already been, and what is to be has already been. So it's like God knew all these things from the beginning. It's not like there's surprises to him. That which is has already been, and that which is to be, the future. He's even got that figured out. This is the confidence that he has in God. And you can see he's talking about God because at the end of verse 15, and God requires an account of what is past. So he's trying to raise that level of awareness that God expects us to do something about this in life. He is going to have a day where he'll require an account. But it's not now. And that's, I think, part of what Solomon had to come to understand. It's not now. God is allowing all these things to happen because he's fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness, as it says in Acts. That's what's going to happen. And he sees that as coming, that God will require an account of what is past. So you don't just live life eating and drinking and doing whatever you want. Oh no, that isn't what he's saying. You live life eating and drinking and enjoying the labors that you've done, recognizing it's a gift of God, and we use that time in serving him. That's what he's going to come to. We serve him and we fear him and we keep his commandments. And that you realize all the way through this that we will have to give an account. And he'll mention that again when he gets to chapter 11, that the time will come that for all these things that we do, we will have to give an account. So he's not just pretending that doesn't exist. He sees God is using this as a way of channeling our life and directing what we do. And at the end of verse 15 there. Now, as far as waiting for God's timetable, when you look at other people that just patiently waited on God, you can make a list a mile long of Bible characters who had to learn to wait on God. And this is what's happening in chapter 3. Chapter 3 was all about time. This whole chapter is about time. It starts out, a time for this, a time for that. For everything, there's a season and a time. And our problem is we don't understand the time. But God does understand. He's got a timetable for all the events of our life. And he's the perfect trainer to train us to become his children. When you look at other Bible characters, so we mentioned Abraham and Sarah, how they didn't know. They had to wait and wait. You look at Isaac and Rebekah. They waited 20 years to have a child. You don't pick that up in the Genesis account until you start to figure out, well, how old was Isaac, or how old was Isaac when Ishmael and Jacob were born. 20 years they waited. Look at how Job, he had to wait, and God made him wait and wait and wait until he sent him Elihu. And finally God talked to him himself. There are times in life where God makes us wait. He's trying to teach us to become patient, to become dependable on him, and he's using the experiences of life to do that. Look how David ran from Saul for years as he was waiting for God to make him king. He'd already been anointed king. He knew he was supposed to be the king. And he's got to run away from Saul through the land of Israel, finally run over to Achish and feign madness over there, and he's waiting and waiting and waiting for the day in which God will do what he had promised. But God does this with all of our lives, though, and Solomon's realizing with time. Although God allows you to consider time in the past and time in the future, he's doing that not so that we can totally understand what he's doing. You'll never figure all that out. But we can have the confidence that whatever has happened to us before and whatever will come to us in the future, that God is doing things at the right time. He's in control. There's no time and chance to him. Time and chance is to us, but there's no time and chance to God. God's got this all figured out, and he's bringing experiences into our life that are custom designed for what we need. So forget about fairness. Forget about like equality. You know, I'm going to be treated just like everybody else in the community. It doesn't work that way. God gives people what you need, and we all need something different. And therefore, he has to bring different experiences into our life at the right time to try to train us and discipline us so that we become his children. And that's what I think, that's part of the confidence that comes out of this study, is that you just wait and you patiently watch what God's doing in our life. So what he does now is he uses unfairness. Now watch how this flows as you're going through chapter 3, because he's been talking about time, about God doing things at the right time. So he looks in verse 16, and he says, "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, where there should be judgment in kingdoms," because Solomon would have known all the different judges that he would have had. He would have seen kingdoms that were operating all around Israel, because he knew the different kingdoms that were there. They had people that came in, like the Queen of Sheba did, and others that would come in, and he'd hear about what they were doing. And he looks around, he says, look, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. That's not supposed to happen. All right, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. There isn't this right kind of government going on right now. And the people that have authority, they're not necessarily using the authority to bring about the kind of righteousness and justice that God would have. That this is unfair. This shouldn't be happening. It's like it's wrong for this to be going on. And I said in my heart, in verse 17, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there shall be a time, and there, for every purpose and for every good work. He understood there would be a time. There's going to be a time when God will take care of this injustice. Well, he will take care of those people that are governing and ruling and have control in iniquity. But God will judge the righteous and the wicked. See, this is the confidence Solomon had. He knew God would do it right at some point. And what he had to come to understand is that God's timetable is different than ours. We want it done right now. You know, we're driving here and somebody flies by in the freeway and they're driving 90 miles an hour. We're looking around, where's the cop to get him? You know, it's like this is what happens in our minds. We want justice now. You know, not when it happens to us, we don't, but when it happens to somebody else, we do. And this is the human spirit that we have. You know, take care of it right now. You know, that growing up in school, you see that as kids. You watch kids get away with stuff in school. And you wonder, like, well, why didn't the teacher get him? You know, well, they did it when his back was turned. And you wonder, like, there isn't justice right now in everything. That isn't how it works. But God will at the right time. He will judge the righteous and the wicked. There shall be a time for every purpose and for every work. So he realizes that this is what God will do. So in the meantime, though, look at verse 18. And this is the kind of clincher passage that you're looking for in this book. I said in my heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them. Ah, you're starting to find out, why does God do this? Why is God letting this injustice go on? Why isn't God just stepping in with angels right now and just like taking care of every injustice that's out there, all the inequities that are there? Why isn't he going after the people right now? And he realizes, oh, God's testing us, that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. That's what he's doing. He's running tests on us. Now, look at this from God's perspective. He's got to find out what's really in our heart. He's got to know us. He's going to hand out eternal life. And he's trying to figure out what really drives us. Are we the kind of person that's driven by the carrot and the stick? They know the carrot's out there, and so if God promises us good life now, nice house, good wife, kids, and all this stuff, that we'll serve God. What happens when the carrot's gone? What happens? Does our life fall apart? Do we blame God? Do we turn our back on him at that point? He's trying to find out, what are we really like? And so he tests us to find out that we're really like the beasts. Are we like an animal that's just going to respond to, you know, like our cats at home? They'll do anything for some food. They'll do anything for that kind. They're so driven by food. Is that the kind of person we are? We're just looking for the little reward, and that's what drives us. And so God is running us through these tests right now. He purposely delays so that he can find out what we're going to be like. And that's part of his strategy. We have to wait a while, right? And that's what God will do. So he says in verse 19, for what happens to the sons of men also happens to the beasts. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. And surely they all have one breath. And man has no advantage over the beasts for all his vanity. So look at, you're no better off in the end when you die than an animal. And God's testing people. He's watching to see, when we see those things happen in life, is that going to affect the way we serve our God? All go to one place, and all are from the dust, and all return to the dust. And who knows whether the spirit of the man which goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth? Who knows? So we watch this in life. We see people live and we see them die. And we know that man is mortal and there's nothing that goes on. But does the spirit go back to God who gave it? Does it go back to God? And God's holding it, and he's waiting for the day in which he will reward the righteous. Because there is a time of judgment, and God will take care of it in his own time. We just have to patiently wait for the time. And in this life right now, there may not be justice in this life. There may be all kinds of events that we look at and we say, that wasn't fair. I shouldn't have had to do that. But that's because we're looking at it from a human perspective. We don't think it's fair. From God's perspective, he says, oh, that's what you need. And I want you to trust me. I want you to believe that I'm going to use that in order to turn you into one of my children. And he's expecting us to respond to those events. So we don't just bear up under them. We don't just endure them. As Paul would, he could go on rejoicing that God was working in his life. This is how you have a positive spirit in the midst of trouble. And it doesn't mean that you just go rejoicing in the midst of all your troubles immediately, but you have that confidence that God is working in our life. I really believe that's what Solomon is coming to here at the end of chapter 3, when he realizes that's why we have inequities. That's why you have these injustices going on. God is testing us to find out, are we going to be able to continue doing the right thing in the midst of injustice, knowing that in the future there will be a time in which God's judgments will take place, and God will reward the righteous. He sees that as coming down the line, but it isn't going to happen yet. So he perceived in the end, at the end of chapter 3, I perceived in verse 22. That's another one of those. This is how he's learning as he's going along. I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring a man to see what will happen after him? And this is what Solomon's coming to, is that, look, you don't worry about way beyond. You don't worry about that future, about what's going to happen, like maybe he had earlier on. Instead, you rejoice in what God has given you right now. And you lived to learn for, like, you know, this is okay. I understand that God's working in my life. I'm going to trust him. And you go through life understanding that the day will come in which God will reward us. And we can't worry about all those events of the future and changing our life or like trying to fix all those problems that are coming down the line. Instead, you turn them over to God, because who can bring us to see what will happen after him? And as he uses that phrase, it's three or four times in this book, it seems to indicate he's talking about like after you die. This is going to be like what's going to happen after you die. And God's just testing us to find out how are we going to respond. So you look at how this applies to us, brothers and sisters. Well, what that might mean is that in our life, there might be unfair situations in your ecclesia. You might be a brother or sister who looks around and you think, well, you've had unfair decisions made about you, about fellowship, of divorce cases, of the career choices that you made where people disapproved of your career choice, or past mistakes that you made, maybe morality or whatever choices that you've made in the past, and you come to the ecclesia and people in the ecclesia misjudge you and they don't treat you right, and you feel like you're having to bear up under unfair situations. This is life. And what we can do is either get so frustrated by that we become so discouraged that we give up, and then this book does become depressing. Or you can realize that God is working in those situations. And he's got the time and he's got the judgment. And he will fix things in his day. It may not be right now, but he will fix those times. It could be decisions that arranging brethren have made about whether we can be on an AB board because we haven't done something right or we haven't done this or that. It could be that you're not allowed to lead a CYC or maybe teach a Sunday school class. It could be something about your marriage partner. I remember in the past there were brethren that were allowed to like read on the platform because they had a beard. Whatever those things are in your ecclesia and in your environment, what Solomon's trying to give us is he's trying to give us some helpful counsel on how to live in those circumstances. And what you can do is treat those things to where God's disciplining us. He's treating us to submit. He's training us in ways that may be unfair, but God's time will come. You have to believe and trust him that the time will come when he will fix the unfairnesses of this life. It could be something in your family. Maybe some of the kids that are over here, maybe you weren't the favored child in your family. Maybe mom and dad really favored somebody else, and that you were the one who like didn't get all the special treatment. That sometimes happens. Maybe as parents, maybe you've got difficult children. Or maybe God hasn't allowed you to have children at all, and you're thinking that this is an unfair situation for you. It could be that your spouse mistreats you, or maybe you're looking around in ecclesial life thinking, well, I'd be so much better off if I had that spouse or that spouse or that spouse. See, Solomon's trying to cover all these cases and say the secret to life is to trust God. He uses unfairness now. Don't expect life to be fair from that perspective. It's not fair in terms of like equal and everybody gets all that kind of stuff. We really don't get what we deserve. What we deserve is death. And in God's kindness, he gives us gifts and he gives us things to take home. But what happens, our approach to life is that we've got to realize that God is training us. He's using those experiences. So maybe you will live under a circumstance where you're put in under submission and you're having to live with something that you don't like. Rejoice in the fact that God is teaching you submission, which many of us don't get. You know, I think maybe the girls in our Christadelphian ecclesias, girls are much better off as moms. You're learning to submit all the time. But for the guys, I mean, that's a problem in ecclesial life. We're not real good at submitting. We're used to being in charge and telling somebody else what to do. We've got to learn to submit too. He's trying to train all of us to trust him. And so what you don't get in family life, what you don't get in relationships with spouses and children, you'll get in all these other circumstances. He's going to train us to become his children. And we just have to believe and accept the fact that and rejoice that he's willing to do the training. So in chapter 4 then, what he does is he then moves on and he has a look and he says, I return. So now he's going to look and he's going to consider a new issue. When he says, I return, he usually moves on to something else. And he's going to look at oppression. So he moves on and he realizes when he looks in society in his country and in other countries, he sees that there's all these people that are being oppressed. And he realizes that some people are living with pretty rough lives. When he looks around and he sees like what they have to bear up under. In verse 1 there, he says, look, they don't even have a comforter. And on the side of their oppressors, there's power. So somebody's in control, and there's all these other people that are having to live under their oppression. And sometimes it's so bad, you look at their lives and you think, wow, they might be better off dead. And you can certainly go back through Bible characters and time periods of history where you can see that these kind of things did happen. And he even reflects over the fact that, wow, you know, therefore I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are alive. Yet better is he who has never existed. So he's actually thinking in some of these people's lives, they may be better off being a stillborn child, you know, somebody who never existed than being this because they haven't seen all the evil that's done under the sun. And so he's realizing that, look, in the midst of all this trouble and oppression, he's now starting to understand that as bad as it may be, that God's using those situations to test people. See, this is following on chapter 3. This is not just some totally new item. He's trying to build his case about God does things at the right time. And until he does, we live with confidence that whatever he puts us through, as bad as it may get, God is in control, and he's using these things to test his people. So he sees that if you're one of those people that lives under terrible oppression, that's okay. God's going to use that in order to bring about good. Or maybe you're the kind of person that you put yourself under that kind of oppression. Maybe there's nobody doing it to you, but you live in verse 4. He saw that for all the toil and every skillful work that a man is envied by his neighbor, or what that may mean is that what people are doing, it's not that you're envied by your neighbor, but a lot of the Bible versions translate that what's happening is that the motivation to do the work is because we're envying our neighbor. We're looking over the fence and we're saying, wow, they've got this and they've got that and they've got that. And so we're driven to go out and work because of covetousness. We're trying to get what our neighbors have. And in doing that, what ends up happening is that we end up putting ourselves under that kind of oppression. It's not that somebody's doing it to us. We volunteer for it. We do all the overtime. We work all the jobs. We're crazy jobs. We're flying all over the place. And we've given our whole life to our business. And Solomon looks at that and says, wow, that's as bad almost as the people that had to live under some kind of forced oppression. He's seeing these people that do that. Now, you'll notice that in verse 5, it's good to see his balance. Because he said, look, I'm not recommending that you just quit working. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. So that's not the solution. He's trying to bring balance to your life. This is what wisdom will do. It will bring a balance so that you realize I've got to do my part, but I don't have to overdo it so that I like bring myself into this kind of oppression. That some people, they work endlessly and they're really never satisfied. You'll see in verse 7, I returned and I saw the vanity that's under the sun. And he sees these people that are alone. So these people that are like working and working and working, they're out there to like, you know, get the most out of this life. Or maybe it could be somebody who's working at like going into isolation, thinking they're going to like protect and go into isolation and keep their family totally secure, make sure they're not contaminated by the world or whatever it might be. But you're working, 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 and you sort of like you're putting yourself into this circumstance. Well, he looks at verse 8 and he says, look, there is one alone without companion, and he has neither son nor brother, and yet there's no end to all his labors. For all of his eyes is satisfied with riches, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks the question. He never says, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This is also vanity and a great misfortune. So he looks and analyzes life and sees that we can be the kind of person when we work and we work and we work and we work, and we're like a workaholic. We're out there working and working, and we don't ever have the wisdom to look at time and realize, like, what am I doing this for? And Solomon did. He did have the ability to do that, but other people don't. And so they put themselves into these oppressions like that, and that's what they'll go through in life. And I really think that what happens in our day and age today, and a lot of us can identify with this, you know, there's a real stress out there today to keep up with the Joneses. You know, and this is what's out there in our life. You know, all the advertisements, the geared up stuff of our marketing today is all towards, you got to have this, and you got to have this, and you got to have that. And they put out all those things in front of us. And to get all those things, we got to work, and we got to work, and we got to work more, and I got to do overtime, and I got to go, and I got to fly here and there and everywhere. And we can occupy our lives just trying to keep up with this. Solomon analyzed all this and realized that stuff's not going to bring you happiness and satisfaction and profit. In the end, you're going to look back at that as an older person and you'll realize, like, why did I do that? Did I really think that was going to bring me happiness? He's been there and done that for us, brethren and sisters and young people, and he tries to leave us with his wisdom that don't go that route. That's not going to bring you happiness. But instead, go the teamwork approach. Find people that you can team up with. Get involved in ecclesias. He looks at, like in verse 10 there, when he talks about the benefits of teamwork. These poor old people, these ones that went alone and they thought they were going to go alone and go for it and do it all themselves, and they were going to get all this stuff and have it for themselves. Well, you might do that, but in the end, you've got nobody to help you when you fall. Whereas, again, in verse 11 there, if two lie down together, they'll keep each other warm. But how can one be warm alone? And though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. So you get help in defense as well when you have people to help you out. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So I think his basic approach here is don't be the kind of person who like goes after life and you're like trying to do it all, you're trying to have all this stuff, and you're like a workaholic, and you go off thinking you're going to like fix it all, and you're going to be the kind of person that takes your family and you get it all right, independent of everybody else. But instead, his solution is to appreciate the others. Be the kind of person that's a team player. And you can see how this would work in families and ecclesias. We need team players. We need people that are willing to like get involved in ecclesias and help each other out. We need folks that will show up to Bible classes and seminars, volunteer to help out with CYCs and Sunday school. We don't need isolationists. We need people that will help. And Solomon saw down the line that this would be the better approach. Go the teamwork approach. Realize that two are better. Three are better than two because you can get help from other people. And don't worry about going after the prominent positions in ecclesial life. Instead, analyze your ecclesia and try to figure out what needs to be done. Where do we need help right now? Sunday school, CYC, whatever it is, visiting committees, pastoral work. Analyze what needs to be done and get involved in those jobs. Help out in the ecclesia. Don't go take somebody else's job. Help out and get involved in things that aren't done yet. So that's where he comes to at the end of chapter 4. And what we'll do in chapter 5 and after lunch is we'll have a look at how he actually continues in chapter 5 on this basic approach about going it alone is not good. Don't strive for your own personal glory and your personal riches and all this stuff that you could get. He's actually flowing through a section right now of instead of going for stuff personally, appreciate the value of teamwork, working with others, sharing what you have, and in the end, you're going to find that this is a much more satisfactory way to live and that God can use this to help other people. So we'll pick it up there after lunch. Thanks.